Hello, everyone. Welcome to Kenwood, home of the Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies. I'm Mary Scott Fleming, Director of Adult Education here. Herb Sloan is professor of history at Barnard College, where he teaches and specializes in early American history. There's much I could tell you about Herb and his work, but that would only embarrass him. I promise we wouldn't do that. But I can tell you the list of his publications, articles, and reviews to date takes at least 6 pages. His academic achievements take another. We're indeed lucky that Herb found the time to write and publish Principle and Interest, Thomas Jefferson and the Problem of Debt. Although 12 years old, this is still the definitive book on Jefferson and debt. Here now to connect said debt with the talk title, Thomas Jefferson Shopaholic, is Herb Sloan.
Thank you, Mary, for that generous introduction. One of the reasons I agreed to do this talk this afternoon is that I'm really more interested in what you have to say in response to some of the things I have to say than I am in what I have to say. And that's because the talk revolves around questions that I get from students, and I think you probably get similar questions, those of you who are actually guides on the mountaintop, from some of your visitors, if not all of your visitors. And these are questions which range from the sublime to the ridiculous. And I'll try to sort of strike a happy middle note. I assume that your visitors ask the kind of questions, again, that I get. What is it about Jefferson? Wasn't he rich? Didn't he own a large number of slaves? Didn't he spend money as though it were water and die a bankrupt? And how can you justify, some of your visitors, certainly my students go on to say, how can you justify his buying all that stuff when the liberation of his human chattels should have been his first and foremost concern? And I suspect you get these questions in one form or another on a fairly frequent basis. And at least as I construct the scenario, it's easy to see why visitors may be asking questions like this. When they go up to the mountaintop, visitors see an impressive house with impressive grounds. And I'm sure that in 99 cases out of 100, it's a much more impressive establishment than the place that the visitors themselves call home. I mean, this is, you know, right up there at the top. And when they go inside the house, they see an interior that is full of rare and unusual objects, objects with pedigrees. A fair number of the objects seem to have come from Paris, were acquired by Jefferson in the 1780s when he was our minister at the court of Louis XVI. And some of them, in fact, seem to have been specially designed by Jefferson. These were not simply things he might have bought in a shop, but they were things that he took the trouble to create on some level and then have an artisan make. They all look fairly high style, I think, to today's average American. And most of them, I suppose, are not typical of the things that will be found in visitors' own homes, either because they're old, and few visitors have that array of antiques, or because they're expensive, or because of some combination of both. Now, you and I, having read Susan Stein, know a little bit more about these objects than most of the visitors do. And we know that Jefferson did not purchase at the highest end of the market the kinds of furniture, the kinds of silverware, the kinds of china that he purchased for his residence in Paris, the legation, where he lived as American minister to France. Those objects were substantial, but they weren't the kind of thing that you would have found at Versailles. Or, more interesting to me in some respects, they weren't the kinds of things that Gouverneur Morris, his successor as American minister to France, acquired in the 1790s when he replaced Jefferson and when all sorts of things were available for fire sale prices. And if you read the passport for Morris's exports from France when he left finally during the Reign of Terror, it's box after box of fairly elaborate stuff, and the surviving pieces in places like the Metropolitan and so on only confirm that. And you look at the surviving objects in the house here, and you know you're dealing with a different level of acquisition from the material that Morris picked up. But Jefferson did buy a lot, and some of it has survived, and a lot of it that has survived is found here. And to the average visitor, I suspect, it all looks very impressive, very fancy, very expensive, and perhaps more than a little self-indulgent. What I think this may mean on some, that is to say, what I think the visitors may, how I think the visitors may see this on some conscious or unconscious level, is that it produces an image of Jefferson as a shopper. After all, they're told, and I think I'm not completely misquoting the guides, that Jefferson acquired these things in Paris, and he had to go out and do this, right? Indeed, to get to the title of my paper, I think they're likely to see Jefferson as what we today would call a shopaholic. And here I apologize, of course, for introducing a 20th century term into an 18th century context. Those of us who are paid to teach history know that this is one of the things you don't do, that we don't want to be anachronistic, that we don't want to apply concepts that may be applicable in our own time to people in the past whose lives may have been very different and who may have had a completely different relationship to the practice of shopping and the acquisition of material goods and so on from the relations that you or I may have. And so you may reply to me that this is just a fashionable term and not one to be applied to one of the founders. Nevertheless, it appears that compulsive shopping is not a modern-day designer disease, and that a German psychoanalyst first published a clinical description of the disorder in 1915. So it is at least a product of the late 19th, early 20th century, if not authenticated as an 18th century practice. All of you can probably think of famous shoppers, and I will give you a list in case your memory flags on this. We might start with Marie Antoinette, whose penchant for high fashion has recently been described by my colleague Carrie Weber in Queen of Fashion, What Marie Antoinette Wore to the Revolution. And then there is Mary Todd Lincoln, say, William Randolph Hearst for another, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, Imelda Marcos, and Princess Diana, to pick a few of the ones that will be more familiar. Their addictions ranged from clothing, in the case of Jackie O and Diana, to art and antiques, in the case of William Randolph Hearst, to shoes, the heralded Marcos collection, and to gloves, of which Mrs. Lincoln owned at least 84 pairs. Interestingly enough, the list is predominantly female, and this is something that I think requires some reflection. The only one on this list, which I got from another source, I will admit, is William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper publisher who bought whole castles and had them crated for shipment back to the United States. So, and I suspect if you were trying to come up with shopaholic figures, your list might be predominantly female as well. And similarly, visitors would think of it in those terms. And yet, recent research suggests that men are really just as shopaholic as women. I owe this insight, I have to confess, to an article in the Stanford Alumni Magazine that I read a few months ago. I rarely look at the Stanford Alumni Magazine, which seems to specialize in class notes about people I couldn't stand when I knew them 40 years ago, and whose behavior seems to be as bad today as it was then. But in the midst of this, I came across quite by accident looking for my class year so I could check up on these types. Was a piece that caught my eye on research done by Lauren Corin, a professor emeritus of psychiatry at Stanford. In a recent study of shopping behavior published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, Corin revealed that as many as 1 in 20 Americans suffers from compulsive buying. And the surprising discovery in his study is that men are almost as likely to be compulsive shoppers as women. Compulsive shopping, according to Corin, has been linked to social, psychological, and financial problems. And certainly there is that sort of notion of financial problems in the background here. Corin pointed to the fact that some studies have linked compulsive shopping to an increased risk of suicide as debt increases and the shame of attempting to hide the problem from others becomes overwhelming. Interestingly enough, he argues that men are reluctant to view their behavior as a problem, but that the problem of compulsive shopping seems to begin during the teens or the early 20s. And we know that Jefferson did order a fair amount in the way of books, at least, when he was, in fact, in his early 20s. Men tend to focus more on gadgets, technical items, CDs, tools, books, and cameras, and can become compulsive collectors, sound familiar, and addicted to auctions. Jefferson was certainly keen on gadgets, which in his case are known as scientific instruments and copying machines. And of course, compulsive collector, as I've just noted, accurately describes his behavior when it came to books. What makes this interesting, and here you'll have to bear with me, I may be going a little further than some of you might, what makes this interesting, to me at least, probably has something to do with the fact that I teach at an institution where issues of gender are fairly prominent, that is to say, a women's college. And one of the things one learns in that setting is to pay attention to the way in which certain behaviors are feminized and hence downgraded or marginalized, take whatever term you want, but definitely given a kind of second-rate status. Shopping, of course, is seen in some quarters, at least, as a quintessentially feminine activity. And so to involve Jefferson deeply in this is to put some kind of question over Jefferson's status in terms of gender. What happens when a man is identified as a shopper? And as I once asked when talking to high school students, it was a mistake, but I asked the question anyway, do real men buy brocade? And the answer that many people would come up with is, of course not. You know, but there was Jefferson who had an interest in exactly those kinds of things. So we may be just a bit uncomfortable thinking about the possibility that one of our great national heroes was a man who shopped. Of course, those of us who've read the Papers of George Washington colonial series know that the first president was quite a shopper in his own right, and so were most of the other political figures in the period, my favorite being, again, Gouverneur Morris, who bought extensively across a range of objects, so on and so forth, until he finally married in his 50s. But we don't tend to put the label on people like Washington, and you know, only five people in the United States know anything about Gouverneur Morris, so he's safe. Jefferson, however, seems to be almost a target on some level for this sort of commentary. And of course, with Washington, there's the fact that Washington did not die insolvent, that he provided for the freedom at least of his own slaves after his death. And the whole gestalt of Washington's career with money and objects and so on is rather different from the way in which we tend to visualize Jefferson. So I tend to imagine that Jefferson is problematic for a lot of Americans, including visitors, because on some level he really isn't all that manly. And one says that despite the fact that he was the father of numerous children by more than one mother. I mean, no one is suggesting that there was anything deficient in Jefferson's sex drive, something like that. But there are other affects that Jefferson throws off that seem more problematic. And these can easily be listed. There are things that people said at the time. You know, he wasn't a soldier. We know he, in heavy quotation marks, ran away from the British, whereas Washington stayed and fought, that sort of thing. And then, to come back to the point where I started, he had all of these elegant things in his house, things we know that he took an interest in. And at the risk of being just a little too contemporary, because this is the obvious crack that you almost inevitably find yourself making, we might say that had he been alive today, there would have been no need for Jefferson to invoke the services of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, because his taste was so much better than theirs that he certainly wouldn't have needed that sort of attention. Okay. So on some level, then, there's a connection between Jefferson and all this stuff at Monticello. All this effort to create the ideal environment that he spent so much of his life on. And then, of course, when he had sort of finished at Monticello, because he never really did finish at Monticello, he went out of his way to create a second perfect environment down on the lawn at UVA. Few American political figures have been involved with design on anything even remotely approaching this level. And it's obviously something that Jefferson responded to deeply, the ability to create and create order out of what was a kind of frontier chaos, all those sorts of things that we know about Jefferson and that mark him off as different from so many of his contemporaries, especially contemporaries in politics. And I myself tend to see, in the largest possible sense, the connection between Jefferson and his things, and one of the ways in which many Americans don't quite know what to make of him, that he really is, when all is said and done, the most un-American, the most unlikely of the founders. But to get back to Jefferson the shopaholic, there are all sorts of reasons, as I've suggested, before we start labeling 18th century individuals with modern and somewhat trendy diagnostic terms. People in the past may make themselves available for DNA analyses, but they can't be put on the couch, and our efforts to understand the deep roots of their behavior are, to put it mildly, extremely iffy. Still, I think the shopaholic notion may fit rather well with Jefferson, and as someone who's long been convinced that Jefferson exhibited a remarkable number of obsessive-compulsive tendencies, it doesn't really surprise me that this sort of behavior, obsessive-compulsive behavior, extends over a wide variety of fields. But, and it's the critical but in what I want to say this afternoon, identifying Jefferson as a shopaholic illuminates some aspects of his behavior and his biography, but I think it doesn't answer many or even any of the questions that I posed at the outset. Jefferson madly running through the shops of Paris has very little, I would argue, very little, if anything, to do with why the enslaved families at Monticello had to be sold after his death in 1826. And this is one of those points that it's often hard to talk to people about because it's so easy to say he spent everything he had and that's why he ended up a bankrupt and that's why the slaves had to be sold. And to try and look at this in a somewhat more complicated way can be seen as excusing behavior that none of us wants to excuse. And so we feel somewhat conflicted, as my friend Peter Onuf likes to say about Jefferson at every possible turn, about the great man in this setting. What we so often ignore, at least those of us who are fond of using Jefferson's purchases in Paris as the leading example of his shopaholic behavior, is that by and large he wasn't really spending his own money to buy the chairs and the silverware and a lot of the rest of it that ended up on display at Monticello. And here the term I want to introduce, which may not be familiar to everyone, although I suspect with this audience I'd get a bigger degree of recognition than I would elsewhere. The term I want to introduce is called outfit. The outfit was, in effect, a sum of money that early American diplomats got that allowed them to hire a residence, to buy what they needed to put on a sort of appropriate level of display as an American diplomat, chairs, tables, dishes, silverware, all that sort of thing. And it was expected that each diplomat, when he went abroad at the ministerial level, and that's what Jefferson appointment was, that each diplomat would go out and purchase items for use in the legation, not embassy in those days, because the United States didn't have embassies until the end of the 19th century when it finally got to be a big power. But each legation was separately hired by the new minister. Each legation was separately furnished by the new minister. Each legation was, in effect, a reflection of whatever that minister's taste was, or perhaps of his secretaries or someone else, his wife's, someone in the families. But it was done, it was a sort of purpose-furnished establishment. And then the nifty thing about all this was that when you had finished your term as American Minister Plenipotentiary to France or Great Britain or one of the other countries to which we sent diplomats in those days, you got to take it all home with you. You didn't have to return it to the federal government. It became your property. And this was a kind of perk that worked the way a lot of perks in the 18th century worked. Today, at least as far as I understand it, there's an office in the State Department that furnishes embassy residences, so on and so forth, and you don't get to take all the stuff home with you when you finish being ambassador to Luxembourg. But in those days, it was rather different. And we know a fair amount about this practice because all the famous early American diplomats were engaged in this practice on one level or another. We know that all of them sent home hundreds of boxes of items, of furniture, of books, of china, all the other kinds of things that they acquired on the government's tab. And that's true of Jefferson, it's true of Benjamin Franklin, it's true of John Adams. And you can just go down the list of these people and see, in effect, how European high style or medium style goods came back with these privileged Americans who were diplomats and furnished their houses. I suspect, and again, Susan Stein would know this better than I do, that there's probably more of the outfit left at Monticello than there is any place else, any other house. You're going to tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I'm just going to ask a question that either points out my own failure to check up on something, or suggests that I do recall that Jefferson asked for compensation to reimburse him for his outfit, but that this was denied, and he made quite a fuss.
That's happening before 1789. And then as Barbara Oberg, who knows this material somewhat better than I do as well, will point out, in the 1790s, he and John Adams worked to make sure they got compensated for this. Much after the fact. But that, for those of us who read the papers and see how incredibly long it took for anything to get settled, the fact that it may have taken 10 or 15 years after Jefferson arrived and bought this stuff with advances from the American banker in Paris to the point where he finally had the account cleared up, it doesn't seem surprising, given accounting practices and the government's behavior. It was extremely important for Jefferson to get this settled so he'd get the money back, and because he wanted this account cleared up so there wouldn't be any balance against him on the government books. And people who didn't do that sufficiently in advance of disaster, like Edmund Randolph, who suddenly had to exit the State Department in 1795 and found himself with unsettled balances that the government then proceeded to sue him to collect under Jefferson's administration. One of the reasons why Randolph hated Jefferson in later life and defended Aaron Burr and so on, you could get into big trouble if you didn't get your account settled. So eventually Jefferson did get his account settled, and at a point when he and John Adams were not really what you would call bosom buddies, he and Adams were sort of working together to make sure that each supported the other in pushing this through the State Department and the Treasury Department. So eventually we get this. And then as the United States becomes a more fiscally established nation, the outfits become regularized. And so there are a certain number of dollars, several thousand dollars is provided. And for those of you who really want to find out how this system could be abused, one of the best books I've ever read on early American political history is by somebody no longer alive named James Wilmerding, who wrote a book called James Monroe, Public Claimant. And James Monroe was the biggest pig at the trough in the early republic. His abuse of the outfit and his effort to collect double outfits and so on and so forth He'd be sent as American ambassador, minister to France in 1803 to do the Louisiana Purchase stuff, and then he'd take a side trip to negotiate another settlement with the Spanish, and he'd write back demanding two outfits because he'd been two separate ministers. And Jefferson actually has to take a fairly firm line with Monroe that this, you know, we're not really doing this with outfits anymore. We're a much more frugal setup than they were in the 1790s. And it makes Jefferson's manipulation of Monroe is always interesting to watch because Monroe is testy and Jefferson has to manage him. But with the outfit, you know, Jefferson draws a line. And unfortunately, as I was saying to somebody at lunch today, we don't know enough about the outfits and about how they work, and we certainly don't know enough about what people brought back with them. I think we know far more about what Jefferson brought back than we know about other people because the records aren't quite as complete. We know that there were hundreds of boxes involved for Franklin, for example, but we have very little idea of what was in them. And for various reasons in the Franklin family, this stuff has been dispersed and lost and so on. For those of you who've visited the Adams family mansion in Quincy, and I assume some of you have done that, some of the furniture in the parlors is furniture that was brought back from France by Adams diplomats and acquired under this same system of an outfit that was part of the, in effect, the compensation that the ambassador, or the minister, to use the proper term, received. So it's not the case, and I don't want to be understood as saying that everything Jefferson bought, he bought with government money, and so we can't say that he was spending money that he should have saved to free his slaves with. But the period in which a lot of the secondary literature describes him as doing major shopping, namely the years in Paris, is a period that isn't quite at the level of Jefferson, selfish, destroyer of his slaves' chances for liberty, so on and so forth, and very much more explainable in terms of what he had to do as an American diplomat in Europe, given the way in which there weren't any permanent legations, there wasn't any permanent sort of State Department housing staff to fill your bed linen closet and so on and so forth. And if people can sort of, what am I trying to say, I suppose, if people can reduce their expectations of just what Jefferson was up to and think more about the books and the scientific instruments and the gold watches for the grandchildren and so on and so forth, not to mention the wine, we may get a somewhat less overdrawn picture of Jefferson as a shopper. Okay. Now, so I'm now reading my notes again, and the moral may be that if it's here at Monticello and it's French and it's not a book, and Jefferson acquired it in Paris, the likelihood that it is that it may have been paid for by the United States government rather than out of Jefferson's own funds. But I don't want to suggest that this is all benign and that now we've shown that Jefferson doesn't overspend in Paris, et cetera, et cetera. Because I suspect, and this again is guesswork on my part, that Jefferson's experience in Paris of being able to go out and shop and shop and shop, and I think he enjoyed this. I think this was something that he was interested in, especially when he came to the creation of the special silver objects that are in the house. I think this had an effect on him, and it may have encouraged him in habits that were not wise. To put it mildly. Okay. We know, for example, that there were moments in his life when he realized that he had to cut back on his expenditure. And one of those moments, of course, is in 1809 when he leaves the White House and he suddenly realizes all those newspapers I'm subscribing to have got to go, I'll just keep one or two. And a whole bunch of other economies have to be made because he found out that he had overspent despite his generous salary of $25,000 a year. But in 1790, 1793, when Jefferson comes back from France and assumes the office of Secretary of State, there is a pattern of what one can only describe as perhaps unnecessary expenditure Jefferson is all of a sudden redoing all of the quarters that he rents, either the house on Maiden Lane in New York when the Capitol was in New York in 1790, or the places he was living in Philadelphia after the Capitol moved there at the end of 1790. And you have the feeling that very little of this was could be justified as necessary, and we know that other people at the secretary, the cabinet level in the administrations of Washington and Adams didn't really do this. And there are all these stories about poor Timothy Pickering, who was so poor that he had to open his own front door, unlike Jefferson, who owned slaves who could do it for him. So not everybody in the government was living the way Jefferson did. And one imagines that some of that was a kind of hangover from the Paris years of the ability to spend without thinking too much about tomorrow. So was Jefferson a shopaholic? And I suppose my answer is yes, because I'm sort of committed to that way of looking at him. But again, does it affect the outcome in 1826 in a significant way? And I don't think it does. I mean, I really do separate these, the personal characteristics and the specific series of events which leads to the collapse of any chance of Jefferson's getting out of debt after 1819, when the panic of 1819 begins, and then the general collapse of land values and slave prices, which means that when his estate is settled, even then, the sale of the land, which isn't really, nobody wants Monticello, frankly, the sale of the land and the sale of the slaves doesn't produce enough to clear the books. And the settlement of Jefferson's estate goes on until the early 1850s. Again, an example of the way in which things, those kinds of financial transactions in the past get dragged out and dragged out and dragged out. And certainly one of the things that I look forward to in both the second series or the retirement series of the Jefferson Papers and perhaps seeing someday on the website, which has so many absolutely fascinating things to look at, and more every time I go visit it, is a better explanation of how Jefferson's estate was settled, perhaps who the purchasers of the slaves and so on and so forth were. There's a lot of interesting information that needs to be gathered and put into some kind of useful form that tell us more about these last unfortunate days. So, from my point of view, Jefferson didn't necessarily have to die a bankrupt. Jefferson did not necessarily spend himself into a position where he was unable to sort of end the days with the books balanced. Jefferson was a victim, and this, of course, is a convenient excuse, those who don't believe that Jefferson was a victim are likely to say. But he really was a victim, and you know, like the Americans today who are suddenly discovering, and if you've been reading the newspapers recently, you'll recall this, that they're unable to afford their mortgages and are in deep trouble and are going to lose everything they've put into these subpar housing facilities they've bought under circumstances which would not be advisable had anybody been thinking about this. Lots and lots of people end up in situations where there are a lot of others, let's say, who are partly responsible for what happens. And again, it's hard to talk about this without sounding like you're justifying Jefferson, especially if you've described him as having shopaholic tendencies. And how can you possibly say this, to return to the point at which I started out, given that what happened to the slaves was simply unforgivable. It was an immense crime. And somehow Jefferson is there, and isn't he the one who's really to blame? Because we have this tendency to look for somebody that we can finger and say, you're absolutely responsible. And the failure to accept that as an attitude suggests that somehow you haven't absorbed the magnitude of the crime that's being described. Okay, I told Mary Scott Fleming when I was thinking about this paper that perhaps I ought to say at the end, on a slightly different tack, a word or two about what the $100,000 Jefferson died owing is in modern-day money, because that seemed to be another kind of question that people ask. And I'm sure I've already convinced you that I refused to take a sensible position on almost anything. So I'll go on and say I'm not going to take a sensible position on this either, but I am going to give you some points to think about. It's very hard to make comparisons between 1826 and 2007. The whole notion of being able to say a dollar in 1900 is worth, you know, $500, whatever, in 2007 depends on an immense chain of assumptions. And if you really want to find out about the assumptions that go into those kinds of calculations, there's a wonderful website called www.measuringworth.com. And then there is a spectacular book by somebody who is not here this afternoon but will be with us for the board meeting tomorrow, John McCusker. And his book has one of the best titles of any book that I've read in a long time. How much is that in real money? And John takes you through the arguments that establish both the pros and cons of making these kinds of comparisons. Now, I started out last week by trying to make a few comparisons of my own. And I thought about, well, what would be a way to sort of concretize what people earned in the early 19th century and how much that would be worth today. And of course, you go for the easiest numbers you can find, and one of them is the president's salary. And Jefferson earned $25,000 a year. George Bush earns $400,000 a year. Does that mean that the $25,000 a year establishes a benchmark? And so if we multiply early 19th century values by 16 to get $400,000, we come up with the 21st century equivalent, so that Jefferson's $100,000 of debt would have been something like $1,600,000 in 2007 terms. And yet somehow that just doesn't seem right. It's not enough. If Jefferson really was this rich, so on and so forth, it's got to be a lot more than that. So that comparison can't be right. And then we think about, well, you know, we're trying to compare somebody who owned people with someone today who can't own people by definition. And how can we even possibly compare the market basket of goods in 1826, rather, that includes slaves with the market basket of goods in 2007, which doesn't include slaves but may include, you know, CDs and all sorts of other things like that that weren't around in Jefferson's day. So you get a little nervous about looking for easily translatable data. And then I went online to the Wikipedia, which is actually, I confess, I'm addicted to the Wikipedia. You can't find anything more fun to play with than the Wikipedia. And I looked at the history of presidential pay, and I found out some rather interesting things. According to that set of comparisons, the $25,000 of the initial salary in 1789 is worth $531,000 today. And the presidents who were actually richest in terms of today's salary value were William Howard Taft and Woodrow Wilson, whose ostensible $75,000 salaries were actually worth about $1.6 million. So poor George is way behind, you know, the historical highs for presidential compensation. And then, of course, you begin to think about the fact that Jefferson paid for everything out of his $25,000, and the only thing George Bush pays for is dry cleaning and meals in the family quarters. And everything else is on a White House entertaining budget, a White House employee budget, so on and so forth. Jefferson paid for his own chef. George Bush does not pay for any of the five chefs currently employed in the White House. And we get, again, this market basket problem that makes it so very difficult come up with adequate comparisons. If you do, in fact, visit measuringworth.com, you'll find out that $100 in 1826 is the equivalent in purchasing power of about $2,102 in 2006, so that Jefferson's debts would have been worth about $2,100,000 in our contemporary values. But again, I don't find that terribly convincing, and because $2 million is not much. I mean, I'm sure some of you have estates worth at least $2 million. And heaven only knows, real estate in Albemarle County can reach absurd prices. So do we really think that that gives us an adequate picture of Jefferson? It's tough. And again, I know that your visitors probably want that information. Well, only $100,000. Gee, I make more than $100,000. And I'm a, you know, impoverished university professor. So that can't be much money. So he's got to have really, you know, owed millions and millions and millions. And, you know, just tell me that it was actually $25 million and I'll go home happy. But I don't think you can do that. And I think that's one of the problems of interpreting the late 18th and early 19th century, is that we don't actually have equivalences. The past is, to use a phrase that's not very original, the past really is a foreign country, and Jefferson is about as foreign to us in many ways as any of the inhabitants of the past. And I'll quit there before I get myself deeper in trouble. So I will be happy to take questions.
One housekeeping detail before we start. If you would please speak clearly, and then Herb will repeat your question, because we are recording this for the many people who wanted to be here but couldn't get here.
Yeah, and do speak clearly. My hearing is not what it once was, along with brain power and various other things. Yes. Okay. The question is, clearly he had exquisite taste, but wasn't he saddled with debts from his in-laws? And here I take a little issue with the words you're using. One of the things that I tried to show in the book I wrote a while ago was that nobody inherits debt. You have to take some positive action to make you responsible for somebody else's debts when that person dies. And Jefferson, by the way, he tried to settle his father-in-law's estate, sort of took the property, the land and the slaves, before the debts that John Wales owed to his creditors were paid off. And they were big debts. They were debts for a huge shipment of slaves and a bunch of other things like that. And by taking the assets before they had been distributed to the creditors to whom they rightfully belonged, Jefferson made himself responsible for all the debts. And this is complicated. He had several brothers-in-law who were also responsible for this, but he was the one who had the most money, and he was the one who ended up paying a lot of it in the end. He had no expectation at all that this was going to turn out to be a disaster. And it's only because of the Revolutionary War, which somehow got in the way, that this happened with the Treaty of Peace, which made the debts that his father-in-law owed to creditors in England come alive again. They'd been abolished, in effect, by Virginia. And then the Peace Treaty of 1783 said, oh, no, you've got to do this all over again. And Ware against Hilton, the great Supreme Court case in the 1790s that involved Jefferson and his family, says, oh, yes, you know, treaties are supreme over state laws, so on and so forth, according to the Supremacy Clause. So Jefferson gets himself in this situation. But when he's in Paris, and you would think he might be a little worried about this because he knows perfectly well what's in the Treaty of Peace, he doesn't understand very well what his financial situation is until late in the period of his ministry, when suddenly he starts getting letters from his manager here at Monticello who say, things aren't really going very well. You know, there isn't much to report on the plus side. And so he gets a little bit more worried at the end. But then he comes back in 1790, and what does he do? He arranges for all these private sales of slaves to get rid of a lot of this debt, and he manages to clear off substantial amounts. And then, of course, he never manages to do it all. If he had cut the umbilical cord, sold everything, so on and so forth, in the 1790s, maybe he would have been debt-free. And then he would, of course, had to go back to work as a lawyer and do various other things that he was probably not too keen on doing. But it's easy to say he should. in some ways, I think that's being wise after the fact. And we tell this story in reverse, which is another problem about the story, that we know how it ended up, and so ... had to be the steps that led to that particular end, rather than trying to think ourselves back into some more fluid picture of his life, in which he didn't know that there was going to be the Panic of 1819. He didn't know that endorsing Wilson Carey Nicholas's note was the kiss of death until after he'd done it, of course. And so it's not all laid out in a perfectly straight line, if that makes any sense. Yes.
Please tell us some detail about the lottery and why that never came to fruition.
This is the lottery that his grandson and other friends and family members tried to organize at the beginning of 1826 that was going to produce enough money so that Monticello wouldn't be seized and somehow Jefferson would be able to end his days in peace. And American policy in the early 19th century highly disfavored lotteries, and you here in Virginia should know that better than anybody else, because one of the leading constitutional law cases in the period in 1821 is Cohen's against Virginia. This was a big deal, and Jefferson actually was quite concerned about it for reasons that didn't have anything to do with the lottery. A couple of brothers tried to sell lottery tickets in Virginia, in Norfolk, and the lottery had been authorized by Congress. So they assumed that even though Virginia forbade lotteries, they would be able to get away with this because they were selling lottery tickets that Congress had authorized, and Virginia couldn't forbid that. And they're arrested, and all sorts of interesting things happen, and the case goes to the Supreme Court, where John Marshall hears it. And although Marshall makes some, the case is remembered because of Marshall's decisions about the Judiciary Act and Section 25 and so on. In fact, Marshall upheld the conviction of the Cohen's brothers for selling lottery tickets. So lotteries were a bad deal in Virginia, and you had to get special permission to hold something, and basically it was too little too late, and there were too many different people trying to save Jefferson in different ways. So some people were raising subscriptions, some people like Jeff Randolph were out for the lottery, and by the time it became clear that they might be able to have a lottery, Jefferson essentially was on his deathbed. Whether this would actually have done more than provide the temporary kind of relief, I'm not sure. But again, politicians, presidential politicians in that period had a habit of dying impoverished or bankrupt. So, I mean, James Monroe is bankrupt when he dies. The only way Dolly Madison survives is by selling off the Madison papers, so on and so forth. And there are these sort of catch-as-catch-can ways to try and clear up these messes at the end, and the lottery was one that didn't really work. The lottery, like the disposal of Jefferson's estate, is a subject which could use more work, and I'm looking at Jeff Looney because I'm sure that volume will come out any day in which the lottery is thoroughly described. So just hold your breath until Jeff gets there, the retirement series. Professor Onuf.
Tell us a little bit about who would be likely to make interior decorating decisions during Jefferson's day.
Who would be likely to make interior decorating decisions during Jefferson's day? And you mean other than Thomas Jefferson?
Well, I want to get at the gender implication that you started with.
Okay. First, fortunately, because there's always something to fall back on, we have an excellent edition of the papers of Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who might in fact be called America's premier interior decorator during the years when Washington was president and Madison, so on and so forth. And Latrobe was British, so he had been a student of Sir John Soane, who was the great British architect of the period, and had this very fancy, up-to-date taste. One of the things that we know about Jefferson is that his taste was way out of date, and that it sort of fossilized in the 1780s and never, went with the times. And La Trobe has a lot of trouble with Jefferson because Jefferson thinks he can come up with the decisions for how the Senate chamber and the other parts of the Capitol are supposed to be decorated, so on. And La Trobe knows he knows better, but you can't really, you know, be too nasty to the boss. So I think the answer, besides pointing to La Trobe as an Englishman, so already suspect, is that, and here I would fall back on Washington, is that a lot of the interior decorating decisions at Mount Vernon, for example, are made by Washington. He's the one who picks the colors. He's the one who plans what the ballroom is going to look like, what the additions, what shape the additions to the house, the original rather small house, are going to take. But nobody ever fingers Washington in the same way that they finger Jefferson, I think. And that's what makes the Jefferson issue so much more interesting. And you know, you could always say, well, it's because George Washington, just sat down and wrote out orders to his merchants in London, something like that, whereas Jefferson actually went out and got stuff himself. But there is also, to keep this at the level of big-time politicians, Washington is asking Gouverneur Morris in 1789, I want the fanciest stuff to put on my table. There were sort of decorations that people put on a dinner table in those days. And you're in Paris. That's where these things are found. I want you to pick out the most fashionable. And all of these guys, the most fashionable is like a leitmotif. It echoes throughout their letters because they're all scared provincials who think they're going to make a mistake. And so Gouverneur Morris finds this stuff and sends it back, and Washington puts it on his dinner table in Philadelphia. So there are lots of men in the 18th century.
And not a lot of women.
I would not say that was necessarily true of Dolly Madison, and I think we have a fair amount of evidence that Dolly was the tastemaker in that family. But you'd say, well, that's after, 1809, something like that. But again, to the extent that we're talking about the past as a foreign country and so on, decisions that might not be made by the male of the family today, as I'm sure you didn't make them in Gristmill, no. Whatever. Sorry about that, audience. were often made by men whose patriarchal roles extended all the way across the spectrum in a way that you would not expect men to be involved today. So looking back at Jefferson behaving this way creates an even further, Brechtian alienation effect from our third president than we might have otherwise. Susan.
There's so many things that I look forward to talking with you about in your as a result of your very good talk. But I'm thinking about the term that you use, shopaholic, has a certain implied pathology to it, which you discussed. But in Jefferson's purchases over, let's say, for example, Paris years, have you analyzed them by both, or quantified them by both date and cost, so that one might create an understanding of what his financial understanding was of his position? I know I haven't actually charted the dates, for example, of household purchases. But it seems to me that if you say shopaholic and take that sort of use that pathology, that there ought to be a kind of construct about what defines that shopaholicism, what it is.
Yeah.
And in the purchase of art, I wouldn't say that he was a shopaholic exactly, because how do you define, how are you defining shopaholic? Is it the breadth? Is it the, we would say that Imelda Marcos, for example, is a shopaholic because she buys excessive numbers of shoes, excessive shoes. But what of Jefferson's behavior exactly is excessive? would you term excessive? And also, what kind of expression is Jefferson, what is this saying?
Okay. Now, I'm not going to be able to repeat the entire question, but let me try and catch some of the highlights. Susan Stein is asking just what am I, how am I really using this term shopaholic? Given its contemporary set of negative meanings, can we really apply it to Jefferson, particularly in the 1780s in Paris? Could we, for example, see whether there was a pattern of rationality in Jefferson's purchases by charting out the dates on which significant items were purchased? And here I would add to Susan's point that I bet if we did that, we would find that they were higher at the beginning than they were at the end, that it was getting the legation furnished that was responsible for a lot of this stuff in 1785. And then she asked a very interesting question that I hadn't thought about, and again, this is sort of all, you know, I did not sit down with the memorandum books and do vast amounts of homework, which would be required if one were really going to carry this project out. But she asked a very interesting question about Jefferson's acquisition of art. And apart from the fact that it takes a real aficionado of a certain kind of 18th century taste, at least for me, to appreciate what he's got on the walls, because it's not exactly, you know, your favorite English, conversation portrait kind of stuff that Americans tend to like. What would you say about that? How many portraits do you need? And there's always the question of what 18th century taste said about the amount of stuff you had to have on your wall. Was Jefferson going beyond those limits? Did he stay well within them? If people actually went into other social spaces like the Salon Monticello in 1800, would they see a similar array of artwork? Or was it like Washington's Mount Vernon, which had a kind of earlier decorative scheme in which there were a lot of engravings because those were cheaper to come by, whereas Jefferson had this real opportunity to buy oil painting, which was not easy to come by in the United States, and oil painting, which often copies of Renaissance works and things like that. And that, too, becomes an interesting question about how do you evaluate what Jefferson was doing in 18th century terms? Because, again, it's easy, as I think I just proved, to slip into the shopaholic notation as a kind of 21st century shorthand for behavior that we may not completely understand. And you know, the Stanford professor who writes the article was clearly talking about contemporaries, and his contemporaries, our contemporaries, and not about people in the past. And there is some literature on shopping and consumption, and in fact, another one of my colleagues, I have all these colleagues who work on how women spend their money in the past. Carrie Weber, who did the book on Marie Antoinette that came out recently. Lisa Tiersten, who writes about these things in late 19th century France. And they are trying to get at some of these questions about what did it mean to have a certain kind of taste, what did it mean to do a certain kind of acquisition of things. And it may have progressed in a very different way from the way that we imagine when we use a word like shopaholic. And I will certainly confess that I was trying to be at least a little tiny bit provocative by applying that term to Jefferson, whatever you may think. Yes.
Hmm. And in their study, they chart the who the purchasers of the books are, what their professions are, how many books they bought, how frequently they bought them, and how much they spent on those books. So if one then lays over that study the person of Thomas Jefferson,
And one can see that he, of course, belongs to multiple professional categories. He's a planter, he's an attorney, he's a politician, he's a farmer, so forth. And it becomes clear almost immediately that the rate of his book purchases, that is the periodicity, the number of purchases, and the amounts he spends on them far exceed almost anyone else in the colony, except perhaps for the bird family.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it gets more when he goes to France.
Study through the memorandum books and other purchasing categories, one might be able to answer the question whether Jefferson as a shopper in wine or clothing or furniture or art or what have you really does qualify as what we would call a shopaholic.
Well, this is a question is using the example of the Virginia Gazette day books, records of book sales to Virginians, and this was not the only bookstore in colonial Virginia, close to it. So lots and lots of people got their books from the Virginia Gazette office. And the point was made that if you put Jefferson's purchases, graph them before 1776, I guess, against these purchases, he comes out to be about the biggest book buyer in Virginia, to which the point can be made that that was just the beginning. I mean, he didn't stop, and he went after books in a determined way, shall we say, for the rest of his life. And as soon as he sold the library here to Congress in 1815, he immediately started acquiring another library, which ended up in the four figures of volumes, so on. And it's never been clear to me whether he actually read all of these books. I think some of them were mainly reference tools that he had around. But he read a lot of them. And he did more of this than his contemporaries did. But the book buying is not quite so damning, if that's the word, as some of the rest of it, because we can accept Jefferson, the great mind, the author of the Declaration, the man who, you know, carefully read in all these different languages, so on, without, I think, having the same kinds of reactions we have to other things about Jefferson. But I would agree that a lot more comparative work needs to be done. And that, then one of the other things that you have to take into account is the fact that after the war broke out in 1775, things changed and people's economic behavior changed. And it was hard to get stuff for a long time. And the post-war depression meant that people weren't really expanding on the same level that they had been expanding in the 1760s and early 1770s. So Jefferson is doing his acquisition in Paris at a time that I imagine there are very few members of the Virginia gentry who are furnishing their new houses at the same lavish rate that Jefferson is acquiring stuff for the legation. And then, you know, when he comes back, he's got not all of it. Obviously, there's stuff that's made here after he returns. But he's got a lot of it. And so the purchasing patterns of people after 1800 may seem vastly different from his, because you reach a point where, unless you're going to get a whole new set of dining room chairs, you've got that. And he doesn't need to go out and buy this again. In the far back. The question is, did Jefferson have to die a bankrupt, and were there things that he might have done in his last years that would have avoided that end? I think after 1819, it was all over. I mean, we were just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it does. Because the collapse of values and the fact that he had this unexpected blow and having to pay tens of thousands of dollars for Wilson Carey Nicholas, who just happened to be a relative of his favorite grandson and a bank manager in Richmond who'd been facilitating loans that Jefferson had been getting. And so it was not an obligation Jefferson found it easy to avoid. Once that stuff happens, it's over. But suppose Jefferson had died in 1817 instead of dying in 1826. We would probably tell a very different story about Jefferson So he lives too long, in effect. He outlives the possibilities for his existence in a certain way. In a sense, it's sort of the luck of the draw, and he drew a bad card in that sense. In 1816 or 1817, he would have just sold the library to Congress. He would have had all this money and paid off a lot of his debts, and his land and his slaves would have been worth something. So that while slaves would have been sold, there's no question. I mean, you can't imagine a scenario in which, a realistic one, in which slaves wouldn't have had to have been sold. But it might not have been as dramatic as it was when they were sold after 1826. And again, the whole picture would present itself differently if he had died at an earlier age.
Yeah. As an interpreter at the house, we're often asked, all right, so how was this debt accumulated? What were the reasons? And with a very limited amount of time, usually, to answer that, I'd like your suggestions how we can.
Well, that's where you end up, I suppose, inevitably using words like inherited, because it just gets too complex to talk about 18th century inheritance patterns and how you can't inherit a debt and so on and so forth. But problems in his family compounded by the American Revolution. Jefferson sold off a lot of the land and slaves that he inherited from his father-in-law. But he never got paid for that because of the currency inflation during the revolution in Virginia. And so people paid him, but he got nothing for it. And then he was expected to pay the creditors all over again in his mind because it hadn't worked due to the intervention of the revolution. And that really creates the situation from which he never completely gets out from under. And then there are other kinds of debts. There's some ones left over from his father, his own father, and his family, and then debts that are accumulated when he's spending in Washington and so on and so forth. But he, the idea that Jefferson never lifted a finger to pay his debts is wrong, and I would encourage you not to, to give that impression. Of course, he does that by selling land and slaves. That's how he pays the debts. And his library eventually, but before that he'd sold large numbers of slaves and a fair amount of land. And it's never enough. He never clears it off, so that there's always something there. And then this event in 1819 when the economy falls apart and he gets caught in that is just the final blow, and nothing is worth anything anymore. And he talks a lot about that in his correspondence. So I don't think that's the short answer that's going to work with somehow. So you've got a problem, from my point of view, and I sympathize deeply. Andrew.
Yes, debt seems to be a perennial problem in Virginia. In this period, you have a great credit crisis in 1772. The realization that a lot of farmers are living beyond their means.
Yes.
So my question is, how typical is Jefferson really of other farmers, and how common is this?
Well, I mean, he's not in trouble in 1772. His father-in-law hasn't died, and he hasn't done all these things with the land, and so on. So in his early years, he's not one of these guys who's been secretly taking money from a high official of the Virginia government. And there are suicides and all sorts of things interesting happening in that respect, as the creme de la creme of the Virginia gentry turns out to be skating on thin ice. But that's not Jefferson's situation then. The situation for him basically begins at the end of the Revolution, when it turns out that due to political decisions, his ability to get rid of the debt that he acquired through his handling of his father-in-law's estate is rendered null and void. So he's a later comer. But the theme of debt in Virginia history, at least through the 1830s and 40s, is a constant. There's all this nostalgia. I mean, Virginia is the land of nostalgia, and people like John Roanoke, talk about the ruined homes of my ancestors, so on and so forth, the days when, you know, the Bishop of London was my ordinary, and all this stuff that you can barely believe. But it's real, and the Tuckers write all these awful novels about debt and decline and so on and so forth. And then somehow Virginia gets better in the 1840s and 50s and is a kind of go-ahead place where they're building railroads and doing all this sort of thing. But the period from, let us say, 1760 to 1830 or 1840 is really, it's like, I think I said in my book, it's like Chekhov. It's like the cherry orchard. You know, everybody's sad, everybody's nostalgic, it's being sold off for building lots, so on and so forth. And Andrew Shankman is, Seth Kotler, sorry, is writing a very interesting work on this theme of nostalgia in the early republic when, in theory, everybody's go ahead and it's American, isn't it great? And yet there's this counter tendency that is seen so strongly here in Virginia of those who mourn the past and it'll never be that good again and so on. The present era is full of rude and vulgar types like Andrew Jackson, or, you know, various people like that. Yes?
I'm an interpreter in the house as well, and I'm a great, great believer in your book.
Thank you.
And I base a great deal of my interpretation on your book, but a good deal of time has passed since your book was first written.
Yeah.
Do you now agree with yourself?
Well, you know, do I agree with a book that was published in 1995? And, you know, this book was really supposed to be about political philosophy. It was not supposed to be a book about economics or about Jefferson's personal economics. And Peter and Andrew will know this because I tried to revive a few of those forgotten political philosophy thoughts in a totally bombing paper last year in Fort Worth. And you know, to me, the important thing in this book, if I dare say so, is the stuff about the earth belonging to the living and the need for frequent constitutional revision and things like that. There are not a lot of things I really like about Jefferson, but that's something I really am attached to. And of all the aspects of this book that get noticed, that's the one that attracts no attention whatsoever. And I'm just, you know, how could I have done it better to get that message across in a way that might actually have affected people? I would have somehow stressed that more, and at the same time I would have maybe dealt with some of the issues in respect to debt that I tried to talk about this afternoon. So it was useful. It got me tenure, so I can't really complain. And that's why those books are written. Let me assure you, there is no other human purpose, so on and so forth. But yeah, I would have tried to be more forceful in presenting those sides of the picture, and I realize that that's something that maybe in the gardens where they talk about Thomas Jefferson and ecology or something, they urge that the earth belongs to the living. It's not something that's going to be particularly pertinent at the house, but it was what I wanted to sort of have resonate with at least some of the readers of the book.
Thank you.